I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Iskov, and with me today is Sarah Watson, a writer, producer on Parenthood About a Boy, creator of The Bold Type, and the film reenactment show about Goonies, something to that effect.
Making the Goonies, yeah.
There you go. And Adam Karp, writer, producer, and past guest from The Minus Man, everyone's favorite episode, I'm sure. Once Upon a Time, Teen Wolf. Thank you both for being here to talk about The West Wing with me.
Thank you for having us. I'm 1 week apart, The Minus Man and this.
Yeah, this is a month of Adam Karp on a podcast like it's 1999.
That's a lot.
It is.
We're going to talk about episode 109, The Shortlist. But before we do that, I want to rewind a little bit and ask you guys about sort of your history with The West Wing. Did you watch it in 99? Was it like a show you watched live? And does it hold up for you? How do you look at it now through the lens of a post-Trump America?
Carp, you go first because you're such a
fan. I mean, and Sarah and I, by the way, have known each other a very, very long time, and we were neighbors, weirdly, and that's how we met, actually.
That's funny.
But I did not watch the show in 99. I didn't start picking up the show until probably...
Wait, were you born yet?
Yes, I was born already. Thank you.
God damn it. Not that young, sir.
But yes, it was... I watched it... I didn't pick up the show live until its final season, actually. But the year before that, I watched everything. But the funny thing was, in 99, my cousin had been a, was like kind of a sort of consultant on the show. Or like, you know, just a like a person they used for research. And so one day I got a phone call on my birthday from Martin Sheen, just like wishing me happy birthday. That's in 1999. Cool. Yeah. Which is, and I didn't even watch the show at the time. So it was like, I was like, all of a sudden I'm talking to Martin Sheen, who was, I think, on a boat in the Chesapeake with my cousin. Which was weird, but it was, that was my like first, like, oh, there's a West Wing show. Cool. All right. And then I didn't really pick up watching the show for a long time, but once I did, I watched everything. And I'll say that now, I go to sleep every night watching the West Wing, just about. I have seen every episode of this show so many times because I just will put it on at night. And there's something about it that's like, even in the, you know, post-Trump era, maybe more so, it feels good to engage with government in a positive way. And despite like the problems within the show in certain places, like it still feels good to engage with government in a positive way.
No, I agree with that 100%. I had Alan Sepinwall and Emily Vandewerf on for the pilot, and Emily has thoughts about how this show positively or negatively affected the perception of government in this country, the perception of what it means to work in the White House, all that kind of stuff. I am on this. I'm in the same camp with you, Adam, in the sense, and I don't know Sarah, but we'll obviously my feelings are that the show, as naive as it might be, as sort of, you know, sentimental and saccharine as it might be at times, it just makes you feel good about the possibilities of this country. So if nothing else, I think that that's a positive. But Sarah, what about you? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I did watch it in 1999 because I'm significantly older than Carp. And as I'm...
We're like 5 years apart? We're not that far apart.
He's a millennial. I'm Gen X. It's a whole thing.
Maybe it felt like more when I was 20 and I met you. But we're 5 years apart, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, whatever.
Anyway, so I mentioned this on the Felicity podcast, yes. But I graduated from college in 1998. So I was working my first TV job in 1999. So TV, and that was when TV was starting to just explode, and these one-hour dramas. We were coming out of this era of sitcoms and into one-hour dramas in this really significant way. And I was working as an assistant, and I missed the pilot of West Wing because that was like pre-DVR, if you can believe it.
Correct.
And I had a writing class that night. And the next day when I went into work, everybody was talking about the West Wing. Oh my God, the West Wing. So then because we all had connections to the agencies, I remember like calling up an agent's assistant being like, can I get a VHS of the West Wing pilot?
That's amazing.
Yeah. So then my roommates and I all watched the West Wing. It was one of like our can't miss shows. I started writing a West Wing spec, and then realized it was way out of my ability. But I was proud. I did have like a funny runner in it where Donna adopted this cat that she found behind a dumpster that had like one eye, and she brought it into the White House, and then it ate CJ's goldfish.
Well, you probably had a good...
That we see for the first time in this episode.
Yes,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you probably had a good rhythm for the voices, I meant, right? Am I making this up? Your sample for a long time was a Gilmore Girls sample.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I like the banter, and this was the first show that I was like, oh, yes.
Right.
But I did, at age 22, I did not have it yet.
Yeah.
But I liked trying, and I will say I definitely did a rewatch. I did a rewatch shortly after Trump was elected, just because I needed to feel hope and optimism. Like, yes, it can be saccharine and sweet, overly sentimental at some times, but like, I feel like we need that. And that's what entertainment is. This is not a documentary. This is entertainment. And I turn to it for the comfort. So I did a rewatch right after Trump was elected. And then I did another rewatch when the pandemic started. I did Friday Night Lights and I did West Wing because those shows make me feel good.
Yeah, I did a West Wing rewatch from season 3 onward because I knew that I was going to be doing this eventually. So I didn't want to kind of do them too quickly right back to back. And I actually watched seasons 5 and 6 for the first time in a very long time, which held up a lot better than I expected them to. I think we just, because they're not the Sorkin seasons and yeah, all of that. But just to rewind quickly to the Gilmore Girls thing, I imagine also writing a spec of this show would require a significant amount of research too, right? Like, you know what I mean? To make sure that these characters, which is such a Sorkin staple, that these characters sound incredibly smart, that they know every angle, that they know all the details, I imagine that that's why he sort of, I mean, runs his rooms the way he runs his rooms, which seems to be more of a think tank, if you will. And then he kind of goes off with all the various things that people give him, and he makes everybody sound super smart. You watched it live. I watched it live from season 3 onwards. I think the first 2 seasons were box set shows for me, which was sort of the, I guess, OG streaming way of catching up on a show. Adam, you watched all the box sets, I'm assuming, or did you?
I did, and I would say I've been in a perpetual rewatch since then. So
sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's I did not watch it live, but yeah, from basically 2007 now, so we'll call that 14 years. I watched The West Wing almost every night to my partner Caitlin's dismay. And it was interesting was she did not, unlike maybe us, she could not really engage with it during those Voldemort years of government. She really like just kind of engaging in any way was too traumatizing.
I mean, I will say that watching this episode in its own way in particular, and we'll get into Supreme Court stuff, but this felt quaint. You know, these scandals feel so quaint in comparison to what we've lived through over the last 4 years or so. So I certainly think that that's worth unpacking as well. Like, I think that that comes back sort of a little bit to what Emily was saying about that there is this idealized version of government that we're past now. As much as we would like to think that a Biden administration can course correct us back to something closer to this. I mean, he is Catholic. But I just think that, you know, it is interesting to sort of look at it through that lens. It doesn't make it any less of a show. I love it to death, but, you know.
But yeah, it's funny that Biden thing. Oh, sorry. Go on, Sarah.
Well, what I was going to say is in 1999, I was also, that's when I started to get heavily involved into local politics in Los Angeles. And so I was volunteering on a lot of campaigns and it felt like a really optimistic, hopeful time. Right. And I remember going to an event and Tom Hayden was there and getting to meet him just like completely fangirling about a politician. So I feel like The West Wing sort of happened to coincide with like my own political awakening, It was before we all felt so beaten down and demoralized. Like it really did. It seemed real at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's sort of the Obama thing too. I think that, right. Like that was a politician that people were excited about. That was an administration in terms of all the people that were like, it was filled with so much excitement. It's and I think that's part. I mean, this is also a Sorkin thing too about like him putting these people on pedestals a little bit. It's like the idea that like Josh has fangirls, which I'm assuming is sort of like the Stephanopoulos effect to some degree or another. Which, you know, he was obviously worked in the Clinton administration. I think that there's this idea that like, and it's even in like the Studio 60 pilot when like Bradley Whitford and Matthew Perry are like swarmed by people looking for autographs. 100%. I don't think that's a thing, but you sort of know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Adam, were you going to say something?
No, it's funny when you mention Biden because, you know, there's so much in common, I think, between Biden and Bartlett more so than even Obama and Bartlett was. And I mean, like I even think that line that sort of opens up this episode in the beginning about like, I wanted a Democrat and instead I got you. Yeah. Right. That line from the retiring Supreme Court justice to Bartlett.
Bartlett, yeah.
I think there's a lot of people out there that are feeling some thoughts like that about Biden that are like, you know, I voted for a Democrat and I got a centrist. Yep. You know, which is which is interesting, right? And like they talk about here in this episode how like he ran very liberal and then went to the middle. I feel like generally elections are not quite that way, right? Like everybody kind of goes towards the middle at the election. Yes. And then you hope to find the real person kind of later.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting too. So I'm going to read a synopsis of this episode, give a little bit of context before we get into it. But when a Supreme Court justice retires, President Bartlett has a golden opportunity to impact the court's composition by nominating a favorite judge. But when further study reveals the candidate's conflicting ideology, the president might change his mind and offer another judge. In addition, a headline-seeking congressman on the House Government Oversight Committee accuses the White House staff of substance abuse, a dicey issue for one important member. The shortlist aired on November 24th, 1999. It was written by story by Aaron Sorkin and D.D. Myers, press secretary for the Clinton administration, and teleplay by Aaron Sorkin and Patrick Cadell. It was directed by Bill D'Elia. 12.37 million viewers tuned into this episode, which is crazy. So to dive sort of headfirst into this Supreme Court part of this episode, Adam, you bring up this very crotchety leaving justice who really kind of gives Bartlett the gears. I couldn't help but think about a story that was circulating, I think, last week about how Breyer, I believe, the current Supreme Court justice, who is in his 80s and is obviously a Democrat, refuses to retire, despite the fact that it seems like everyone's just sort of like, can you please leave so we can put a 16-year-old on the Supreme Court that'll be there for a while? And it's just interesting to think about, I mean, the importance that this court has in this country, which is, I might argue, too important. Right. Lifetime appointments, various things, the number, the composition of the court, the various things that seem sort of etched in stone that shouldn't in its own way. And I guess my question to you guys is, do you think this show does justice, no pun intended, to the importance of this court and how this, it just feels as though it's become so crazy over the last two administrations. And I'm not sure that I felt its weight as much in this episode. Sarah?
I don't know if you feel it in this episode per se, but what I would say is that I think it's a 3 or 4 episode runner before Mendoza's like on the court. It is like 3 or 4 episodes, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think that while you may not feel fully the weight, probably because the way they sort of try to introduce that weight is almost through a comical type means. Yeah. I think over the course of the season feel a little bit more of the weight that this is a continuing problem for multiple episodes. And I think that gives it some gravitas and weight and whatnot. And just honestly, also the casting that they have here of Edward James almost for Mendoza just brings weight to these people. And even the guy they got as Harrison, I think really is a really good actor. I mean, and he carries himself in the way that this role sort of demanded.
What I did think was weird, though, is that we've been sort of conditioned to believe that justices are not supposed to be political. And I feel like they've gone out of their way so many times to not be political, even though they're clearly very political, especially now. And so for the outgoing justice to be so influential and so overt with the president in his office about who he wanted on the bench, I was like, you can't do that. That's some Kavanaugh shit right there.
It really, really is. I mean, of the three people that Trump got to put on the Supreme Court, I do think that Kavanaugh's the worst of the bunch in terms of the way that whole thing transpired. The idea that Kennedy apparently said he would retire only if it was Kavanaugh. I mean, who knows how much legitimacy there is to these things, but in watching this specific scene with this justice saying to Bartlett, essentially grow a pair, and stop doing what you think we want you to do and do what you believe in, is interesting. I would garner or imagine that that hasn't happened before. I don't imagine that these justices have these conversations with presidents in this way. But I mean, this was just a really, Mendoza gets more meat in Celestial Navigation, which is coming down in a few episodes, where we really get to sort of get a sense of what this man is all about. He's sort of, I mean, it's interesting to read. I did some research and there was this interesting piece here where apparently James almost heard that they were going to have the White House name a Hispanic to the Supreme Court and begged to let him play the part. At that point, the character was only to appear in one episode. We never said, there's more for you down the road. There was literally four lines, one of which was, thank you, Mr. President. And then they wrote Celestial Navigation. So it is interesting to think about how important this was to a prominent, Hispanic actor. He got into a whole thing about his salary, which I think is amazing, which you talk to the press about, which I think is insane, where they tried to like pay him scale. And that doesn't matter. But this is all just to say that this was a statement within this show to say we want the Supreme Court justice to be, of color and to have to change the literal and figurative, complexion of this court.
And that scene, Sarah, that you're talking about that was like taken aback by the, I wanted a Democrat and instead I got you, that scene, like there's something really amazing about it also where like this episode, which in some sense is like kind of a transitionary episode for the show, that scene does set the stakes for seasons to come, that because you only really can have like a Supreme Court nominee say to the president, right, you're gonna lose in 3 years. So you could, needs to be somebody high up there for it to have weight, to say like Republicans have guts and Americans like guts and you don't got it. Mm-hmm. And he really is setting the stakes for the entire next three seasons, right? Like a base, and the sort of internal turmoil that constantly go through of like, are we doing the hard thing or are we just kind of coasting, is like kind of the dramatic conflict of the entire series.
Sure.
And it's kind of like staked right there with that Supreme Court nominee just putting it in words.
It's also very much at the heart of the Toby Bartlett relationship, right? The two Bartletts, the things that wrestle inside this man, the almost sort of therapist relationship that they, therapist and patient relationship that they have. It's interesting. So you guys were obviously instrumental in me getting Masterclass, which I did get the other day.
Did you see the Sorkin one yet?
I was watching that yesterday in preparation for this, and it's great, and everybody should certainly watch it if they like Aaron Sorkin or if they want to be a writer. I think it's a important thing to watch. But within that, within his Masterclass, he talks about the Rob Ritchie scene with Bartlett at the end of season three, where the oh boy crime, I don't know line, where he's just like, that's when I decided to kick your ass. But that really crystallizes, to your point, Adam, what's said by this justice three seasons earlier, right? Which is this idea of, grow a spine and you can be smart, be the smartest guy in the room. That is, showing guts. I think that is, if there's a theme of, quite frankly, Aaron Sorkin's entire oeuvre, it's that, right? Like being smart is courageous. Do you feel like that speaks to this episode? Do you feel like that's an accurate assessment of him, Sarah?
I definitely do. I mean, like you said, it's like his whole shtick, and it's but it's not even be the smartest person in the room. It's like do the right thing. And I think that goes back to kind of the wish fulfillment of this, and like what we want in politics is politicians who are doing the right thing. And really to have those conversations about race and the necessity to put judges of color on the Supreme Court, to have that conversation over 20 years ago, it was kind of weird to watch this episode. I rewatched it last night again because so many things are in the zeitgeist now. And it's like, how did he know? Like, getting into the whole thing of like privacy and
100%.
Internet. And like the internet was like barely a thing. I had had my email address for like 2 years at that point. So it really was, he just had this like finger on the pulse of like everything that was going on in this kind of creepy way. But then at the same time, other things felt totally dated, like them all sexually harassing each other in the Oval Office.
Oh my God. I mean, yes. We got it. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about the Danny thing in a second too with you, Sarah, because I'm very curious about your thoughts on the CJ Danny relationship. But to the privacy thing was really like the way Sam says, literally says, like the next 2 decades are going to be about privacy. we're very much living in that. I mean, cell phones, social media, which is obviously very much about privacy, looking at obviously what's going on with Facebook and any number of other things. But it's just, it's so interesting that that's the thing, that that's sort of the third rail that they choose to be the thing that boots this other nominee in Harrison. I want to read just a very quick thing that Aaron Sorkin said. He had an interview. He said, I knew that I wanted the story to start with fantastic, everything's great, we've got the person, and to the end with it's a whole different guy. In other words, Sorkin continues, we're going to have to discover a problem within our home run candidate. I didn't want it to be scandalous at all. I didn't want it to be a nanny. I didn't want it to be sex like Clarence Thomas. I didn't want this guy to have done something, anything wrong that I was intrigued by, say, Bork and those who agree with Bork, and the Constitution does not provide for a right of privacy, and the right simply doesn't exist. Not so much of Bork's contention with Roe v. Wade was based on the faulty legal thinking, but more, I think privacy is huge. Sorkin also knew that he wanted the action to take place over a couple of days. The more you compress time, the more heat goes up. I was taught that you want to start your stories as close to the end as possible. I'll sit with Pat, Dee Dee, and Lawrence, and I'll say, write me something about this. Write me something about how that would work. O'Donnell supplied the resume of the perfect candidate. Cadell researched the privacy arguments. Sorkin asked Myers for the ideas of what might undo who seemed like the perfect candidate. She came back with a notion of an unsigned note, a long scholarly article the candidate wrote as a young man on the Harvard Law Review that cast doubt on his commitment to privacy rights. I think it's really interesting too. Obviously, both of you guys have worked on many television shows, and the idea of four people working on an episode is kind of crazy, and is emblematic of the way Sorkin runs a show, which is relatively an anomaly. It doesn't really feel like a lot of people run shows like this, but it worked for a while. I guess my question is sort of, how do you guys feel about group writing? How do you feel about the idea of that versus Sarah's face was amazing. But I think that there's a whole bunch of ways to skin a cat, obviously, right? There's no right or wrong way to run a show, as many people have proven. And I guess I'm sort of curious as to what your thoughts are. Sarah, you've obviously run shows, you know, in terms of how this show was run.
Well, this show was, like you said, no other show is run this way, to my knowledge. And also, I think Sorkin was sort of like the precursor to the auteur shows. Mm-hmm. But he was doing it on a show that had 22, if not 24 episodes a season. So that's just not sustainable. Now, in these short orders, you can have the auteur thing. So I feel like he was doing the auteur thing, but then hiring people to support him and do the legwork. I guess it's sort of how you define group work, because I am a super collaborative TV showrunner. Like, I like the room. Like, I'm not like a lot of procedurals will be like, everybody go break your individual episodes. Yeah. What's the point in having a giant staff if you're not going to like bring everything to every episode and make every episode as good as possible? And I also think that that model kind of breeds competition, which doesn't make for great TV either. What I took from Jason Kadam, I mean, I took a million things from Kadam's, but one of the things I took that I found jarring at first was that he doesn't assign episodes as we're breaking them. And at first I was like, oh, that's weird. How do you know, like, if that's going to be your episode, and like what level of commitment? And then I realized, oh, you give 100% to every episode. Yeah. And then he waits to sort of see, once the episode is broken, whose voice is going to be the best one to write that.
It's really interesting.
It was great, because nobody felt like, oh, this is my episode, so I'm going to hold back on my good pitches and my good material, or this is my episode, so I'm going to give all the good stuff. So It like that kind of collaboration and group writing, I really like. What I don't like is the group writing when you're 2 days away from shooting an episode and you each have to take a scene. And I just think you can't.
I'm well acquainted with that phenomenon.
Yeah. Oh, you just, nobody does their best work. And also, yeah. It's not as cohesive because like what I love more than anything is like you set up something, some tiny character moment in act one that you pay off in act whatever, how many ever acts, 4, 5, 6, who knows on, or there are no acts because it's a streamer, but it's hard to do that if you're group writing. And we used to call it something a lot more, a lot less PC than that.
Yes, less PC back in the day. I mean, I'll say that, first of all, I agree with everything you're saying. And I didn't know that about Jason Kadams, which is fascinating. And I think that it does create a democracy or sort of like, it really kind of flattens out the field and makes sure that everybody's giving the same amount of effort on every episode, which I think is fascinating. I know that that Sorkin obviously, I mean, he'd be handing them scenes like moments before shooting stuff. Like it was a crazy, and he had let's call it extracurricular activities in order to make sure that he was able to find the energy to do what he needed to do. So there's that too. But I do think that it's a miracle that we got 4 seasons of this show, that there are only 3 episodes that he doesn't have a writing credit on. And that's not me saying that he forced his writing credit. My assumption is that he had something to do with every episode that his name was on. And if he didn't, then his name wasn't on that episode, which is to say that there are only 3 out of the 100 or so that he did that he wasn't involved in some way or another. I think it's, I can't imagine it. I don't know how it was done. But to read that paragraph and to see how he sort of allocated certain things of the episode to certain people kind of gives me a little bit of a purview into sort of how he kind of plugged and played people into specific episodes.
But I think it's a miracle that we have this, right? Like it's a miracle that this exists in any way, that this kind of one person's voice managed to write through 22 episodes a year or close to it, even with the, you know, the sort of research support he had. But I 100% agree with you, Sarah, but like about the not wanting to get in that situation where you're group writing things to a day before you're shooting or the day of shooting. But it's interesting that his method almost sets himself up to end up in that situation over and over and over again, where he's delivering the pages, and because he won't, you know, stand, you know, allow the staff to support him, and really in a pounding the keys kind of way, he's having to basically get those pages out like at the last second every day. It's interesting that his whole system sort of points him toward that moment where we all try to avoid being at, and yet in somehow the result, that pressure cooker for him, results in something amazing, at least on the page. We all know what the results are in his, you know, to his personal life, of trying to sure. live in that space. But it's interesting, I have to assume it's that pressure cooker that gets him to that, that place.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think he's just somebody who needs the pressure and needs the chaos.
Right.
I do not. I don't do well with the pressure and the chaos. Like those nights when like you're up all night group writing a script. It's just like, this is crap, but I have to keep my eye on the keys. Whereas I think he, because of that manic energy, it's like that's where his rhythm comes from. And
I'm 100% with you, Sarah. And let me just say, I was on a particular show, and I won't say what it is, where, you know, I was sent off the script and was just writing, you know, like up to that deadline with so much pressure that literally, it sounds crazy, that event gave me diabetes. Like, I mean, it sounds crazy. And we could talk about privacy / medical, but like you can look at my like blood sugar charts and pinpoint it to the month of that event of like when my body tipped over into like having diabetes was the stress of that, like of having to deliver that script and having to rewrite over and over and over and over again, right up until the second of production with like no backup. I had this one moment in time that like will haunt me for the rest of my life. And Sork and Joes are like, live in that moment for 4 years.
It's, what's interesting is, first of all, it should be said that season one of The West Wing is being done concurrently with Sports Night, yes, season two, right? So, like, he's actually doing two television shows at the same time. There's that. There's also the fact that when he does write in a vacuum, like he did for Newsroom, we saw how that played out, which is, and I don't hate Newsroom, but I do understand that it doesn't have the same crackle, right? Like, it feels as though there's no feet to the fire, right? Like, he doesn't feel the walls closing in, so he doesn't, it just doesn't have the same thing. I will also say, too, rewatching this, I did find myself seeing the formula, right? Like, there is a formula to The West Wing, and it is procedural in its own way. Like, it's not overtly procedural, but there are bearing walls of structure to it that you can certainly see that once he finds those rails, which takes probably about half of this season to find it, it does feel like a little bit of, okay, so that's what this is. That's what, like, it feels a little bit, I imagine, quote unquote, easier to do once you have that formula.
And this episode in particular really reveals it, I think, because I think this episode has less storylines than some of the other episodes. It really kind of has two.
Two, yeah.
It really just has, they really dig in on the Supreme Court storyline, and then you have the Lillian Fields press conference around White House staffers using drugs, right? Yeah. But it's interesting that one of the things I think is particularly interesting in this episode is that, like, that storyline, when that speech you mentioned from Sam about what the next two decades, right, of privacy. The one thing he mentions that's interesting, that is a conversation I don't think we've had publicly, certainly not in a big way, is the medical privacy. We haven't had that conversation publicly in a big way, but it's interesting that he mentions that here, and that's the one he chooses to have within the show.
Yep.
Right. Like, within the show, over the next 3-4 years, Bartlett's MS is the, and the, you know, he held that back. That's also here, right? Like, that also started right here with the privacy conversation. And I don't think the show ever decided to rhyme back or sing back to it overtly, that they talked about it, like, right here. But it's interesting
about that. That's super interesting.
You know, but that's their big thing is putting somebody on the Supreme Court who's for privacy, that believes in a right to privacy, and then that becomes the big central issue of the whole show.
Well, I think you're speaking to something that perhaps is Sorkin's greatest gift, which is planning nothing but making everything look like it was planned, right? Like, he doesn't know what's coming, you know, tomorrow in any of these episodes. And yet this is a perfect example of, like, him, and I don't know if it's him, I don't know if it's staff, who knows, right? But if someone pointed to something, the infamous thing about the MS is that he literally just wanted a disease that he could give Bartlett so that he was stuck at home one day and had to, like, watch soap operas or something. Like, literally, it was not even, the plan was not to give him some big medical thing that he withheld. It just worked out that way. Like, that to me is, I can't imagine it. That sounds insane. But in terms of planning, I also want to say that this episode comes off of the only episode basically the run of this show, because the only other two episodes that Sorkin doesn't have writing credit on are in season four when he's slowly kind of leaving the show. The previous episode is Enemies. It had no less than 5 writers, okay? It sounds, just based on some of the reading and research on that previous episode, was a nightmare. And it seemed like he ran out of bandwidth and had to give an episode to other people. And thus, it was like all of these people kind of... So I wonder if this episode, having two storylines that pull a bunch of characters into it, was by design, right? Which was, how do I make a simpler, quote-unquote, episode that involves more... You know, that I can pull Sam and Toby into one storyline, and I can pull Josh and Leo into one storyline, and CJ, right? Like, how do I find ways to pull more people into less storylines, which I think is interesting.
I think that's true. I mean, and I, you know, the results, I think, are really great in finding a simple episode. And I really also think that they managed to kind of put people in their lanes in a right way. This is one of the few episodes where I feel like Mandy is being used in an actual way that a media advisor might be used. She's terrible.
She's a narc.
But she is the one saying, like, this is going to be a media disaster, right? And it's like, but what's funny to me about that is that, like, this, you read the Edward James Olmos thing before, and there is a whole undercurrent to this episode around race, right? They never say it overtly, which is also interesting in its own way.
That's interesting. Yes.
They never overtly say it's going to be a problem because he's Latino, right? They never say that. But the subtext of so many scenes is just that, is exactly that.
Well, this is to bring it back to Mandy, because I want to hear your thoughts on Mandy, Sarah. Mandy is in this episode. She's literally a narc that says everyone should get drug tests. And she's also the person that says, do we really want a Hispanic nominee? Like, it sounds like it's going to be really tough, guys. Yeah. Mandy sucks. Sarah, please tell me what your thoughts are on Mandy.
She is such a thin character and so poorly outfitted. I don't like to comment on a woman's appearance, but I'm going to comment on what they did to her. Okay. They put her in suits that don't flatter her. They did like the Felicity season 2 thing and gave her the worst possible haircut that made her just look so, like, let's take all sex appeal out of this woman. Like, she's a beautiful woman. I have seen her in other things. The cutting edge, that's a gorgeous woman.
Yeah, and it's
so
topic.
They made her so flat and so odd looking. And then we're like, she's a sex symbol. Like,
in they make her shrill too. And I hate to say that because I know that that's a terrible, but you know what I mean? Like, she feels grating. She's always the antagonist to them. Anyway,
she's the worst cliches of everything. And yet in the pilot, they made her like Josh Lyman's like sexy love interest. And like, you can't have it both ways. And I've just always wondered, like, why do you do that to her? That was so mean. Like, get her a suit that fits her properly.
I think they really, watching this again and really kind of trying to unlock the Mandy thing, I really did find myself feeling like,
want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The writers disliked what the character was doing, which was that she was always the one saying, no, don't do this, don't do that. Like, always being sort of a roadblock makes the character really grating, really annoying. You don't need it. I mean, you get when you bring Joey Lucas into the show, which essentially tells you polling data and various things like that, like, you're good. You don't need a series regular that comes in to say, like, media is not going to like this or media is going to like this. Like, it's crazy.
And it's a fine line between that and CJ, right? Like, it's a very fine line. Like, CJ can voice that same that same sort of point of view. But I did feel like this is the one of the few where she is voicing a media point of view, at least, where in so many of the other episodes, you're just like, wait, why are you weighing in on this at all?
Oh, she serves a purpose in this episode, just to be clear. I Sarah, I want to get your thoughts on two relationships on the show that I think, through a 2021 lens, perhaps don't hold up as well as they did maybe in 99. This isn't to say that the performers or that the writing is bad by any means, but the Josh and Donna relationship and the CJ and Danny relationship are two relationships that you would
never do today, right? Like, you just wouldn't do it. Now, it's not to say that the performances aren't wonderful. I think that the Timothy Busfield and Allison Janney make CJ and Danny sing. But, dude, no means no. How many times can this woman say to you, I'm not going out with you? Sarah, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are so complicated because everything you're saying is true, but I was rooting so hard for them. And like, I loved the Donna Josh relationship, mm-hmm. and there was something so fun about it, yeah. and that you could have that sexy banter in your workplace. The problem is that, like, they were so here's where it worked is that, like, Josh and Donna both got something out of that. Like, it was, mm-hmm. They lived in those jobs and they had fun and it made it fun.
Yeah.
What would be a problem is if Donna was not into it and it was making her uncomfortable and she said something, which kind of CJ does to Danny. Yeah. And yet.
Or if she was drawn to Josh's power, which you do not get the impression that she is. Like, in fact, she's taking him down a notch all the time.
Yeah.
You know, she says the thing, she says the things that, she says things to him that nobody else will say to him that are, like, she's very, even in this episode, right? When the guys like are all chest bumping each other, the whole you to men thing, which is like,
oh my God,
the hardest part of the episode to watch. I think
it's so brutal.
He literally says, you guys are gross. And I think it's only because she can say, she does say, go like, you guys are gross, that we can kind of sort of swallow this relationship a little bit.
But Sarah, in terms of the CJ character too, right? Like, CJ starts, I love CJ, don't get me wrong. But I do think that CJ starts from a place of Aaron Sorkin not entirely sure what to do with her. And until it feels like Allison Janney kind of imbues her with the spine and the fortitude, that the character really starts to blossom. How did you, what are your thoughts on the CJ Danny thing, but also just like CJ's character overall?
So to start with CJ's character overall, I feel like what I loved about that character and watching it in 1999, it was that she was a formidable person in that boys club. It was such a boys club and she held her own. And getting back to the physicality of her versus Mandy, part of it is height. And this is something I'm so hyper aware of because, so I am Allison.
You're tall.
Yeah, I'm tall. I actually know that I am about 1 inch shorter than Allison Janney. She's about 6 feet. I'm 5'11". And I know this because I saw her at an awards show once and I was like, I'm going to do the creepy walk by and you're going to tell me who's taller. So I did that. I was like going, I got
that's amazing.
Her, and then like walked behind her, paused while my friend looked. But one thing I have noticed is on film sets and especially with like aggressive film TV directors, mm-hmm. I feel like, and I've discussed this with my female friends who are short, there's something about being able to look somebody in the eye and sometimes even look down. I have used this too before where I stand close to somebody and physically move my head down. So I'm like, I am looking down at you. And that's something that Allison Janney can do.
Yeah,
and like they often have her in heels. She's towers over Sam. And I think there is something about that physicality that makes her, and maybe it's just me because I'm super tall, like being hyper aware of it and like finally wanting to embrace my tallness after like a lifetime of.
Well, it makes me that there's this amazing Super Yaki t-shirt that says, let Elizabeth Debicki be tall. And I think that I feel like they let Allison Janney be tall in this show. Like they really do allow that.
Yeah. And they dress her in suits that like elongate her. And mm-hmm. it's like the opposite of Mandy, who just looks like a little kid wearing suits.
Yeah.
It's funny. I've been on a lot of, right. And it's that thing where you're on a lot of sets where they're putting men in lifts or putting them on apple boxes.
Sure.
Right? Like, so that they are standing up taller than their colleagues or whatnot. Right. I mean, it's interesting that you bring up this thing of they let her be tall.
Yeah. They let
her be tall. It's also, you know, when Mark Harmon shows up in season 3 and they have their relationship, CJ and I can't think of the character's name. I'm sure Adam knows it, but I don't. But she says, I like that you're tall.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they can literally like look eye to eye. It is something that it is just interesting how CJ becomes, I mean, CJ's introduction is unfortunately
falling off of a treadmill, which is also unfortunately a little bit of a Sorkian trope of women falling down all the time and klutzy. And I do think that by the middle of this season, that I can't even imagine that anymore. Like, I can't imagine CJ tripping on something or falling on something or anything like that.
I can't imagine it with CJ, but I do think it's interesting that even this far into the season, Sorkin is still very much trying to figure out his relationship with, like, humor. The way this episode begins with, like, the ceiling block falling down as the button out for the cold open. Like, that, it's clear he's still, like, trying to figure out, like, all right, how am I dealing with these act breaks? How am I dealing with these commercial breaks? How am I buttoning out things? Because it doesn't really relate, like, in a thematic way so much. I mean, they try to really push it with Donna being like, well, something's going to go wrong, and then the ceiling falls. It's not part of the story in any real way.
Well, I think he knows that. I mean, Bradley Whitford is inherently funny, and Allison Janney, both of them know how to deliver a joke. And I guess to some extent, Rob Lowe does in his own little lane. To your point, Adam, it does feel like the show is still figuring itself out. I mean, this is the other thing too. We're only 9 episodes into the show. I know I say only, but like, we are only 9 episodes into this show. This show has basically not been on a break since it premiered. So it's, I don't even know how he produced this show, let alone find the humor, keep all these plates spinning, do all the various things. I do just kind of want to hit a couple things in the plot as we sort of go through it. But the episode essentially opens with Josh and CJ on the phone locking down this potential SCOTUS nominee, whose name is Patton Cabot Harrison III. I don't know.
Donna makes a Jewish guy.
A Jewish guy on the Supreme Court. I also will say that one of the things about the West Wing that you know is that if everyone's excited about something at the top of the episode, they will not get that thing by the end of the episode. So everyone's like, this guy's the guy. And you know that it's just like on ER, if a doctor says you're fine, you'll probably be dead by the end of the episode. So there's sort of these kind of hallmarks of the show. As you mentioned, Adam, the you to man thing or who to man thing, I was just like, oh my God, it's so 90s unfortunate awfulness. Donna tells Josh to be cautiously optimistic, and then the ceiling falls in. There's a fair amount of Josh stuff like this. Josh's chair isn't behind his desk. Josh falls. Josh's suit isn't in the cleaner, so he's wearing fishing garb or something. Like, there's a lot of that stuff with Josh, which I love. And it's very kind of like classically part of the show. I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, guys, because I've been rewatching Friends just kind of on a lark for just, you know, a thing to watch.
For pandemic reasons.
Because of pandemic reasons, sure. And I felt like back in the day, Chandler was like the character that everybody loved because he always had a wisecrack and he was always very funny. Don't find him as charming this time around. I actually find Chandler kind of grating and a little bit annoying this time around. There's a little bit of Chandler in Josh. I feel like Josh is the Chandler of this show. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah. Of this show? Of this show, yes. But I mean,
he's the wisecracking one, right?
Yeah. Like, he's the comic relief for sure.
Yeah.
And we see it. We, you know, it's funny because, right, we have the Matthew Perry and Bradley Whitford are going to star in a Sorkin show
there,
you know, very soon.
And meet up on this show.
You know? Yeah. And meet up on this show. It's interesting. They sort of swap when he goes to Studio 60, right? Yes. Bradley Whitford becomes more of the serious role.
Correct. But I think it's just, it was one of those things that there's sort of these like 90s characters that feel like they kind of defined the show and the decade that they existed in. And I feel like Josh Lyman is that character for this show. And I don't say that in a bad way, but it's also like the reason why you shoot him, right? Like, it's the reason why you put him through what you put him through in season 2 in terms of his PTSD and what have you. So then we have this scene where this retiring justice basically gives the gears to Bartlett, says he should really consider Mendoza. Mandy tells Josh why
asks Josh why Lillian Field is holding a press conference. She doesn't want to be upstaged. Lillian Field says that 1 in 3 White House staffers uses drugs. And then through the course of this, Josh goes to Leo and says, I think he's really coming for you. And Leo admits to the fact that he had sort of a pill addiction or some sort of addiction to pills, and that he had treatment for it. And then Leo goes to Bartlett at the end of the episode and says, you know, this could be bad. This is a thing that they go back to over the course of the series of Leo's addictions, Leo's problems, the Republicans trying to essentially take Leo down. I think we all know that a chief of staff is the hardest job to hold on to, that generally speaking in an administration, if you're lucky, you'll only have 4 or 6 of them. So I'd say that it stretches credibility that Leo would last as long as he did, especially with his various ailments and addictions. But I still love it. It still works. What do you guys think about it?
Definitely. And this gets sort of back to the whole Sorkin thing of like believing in the best in people,
yes.
Which I love is that Sorkin and like Kadams, this is something I got out of working with him a lot too, is that people are flawed. People make mistakes, but people are inherently good. And so you go to bat for them and you fight for them. And so there's something so amazing about, and this goes back to what you were saying about, like, this is not realistic politics. Like, if this were real, Bartlett would have had to throw Leo to the wolves and say, like, I had no idea. This is so difficult, but I'm going to get rid of him and let him go get his life together while I get somebody in here who can steady the course. And he would have used him as a political pawn. Yeah. And so there's something about the wish fulfillment of, like, Bartlett, the ultimate father figure, being like, I'm going to love you no matter what, no matter, you know, mistakes and all, that is really beautiful.
It's that line, that line that he has with him, right? Is the, did you have a drink yesterday? No. Are you planning to have one today? No. He's like, that's all you ever have to tell me. Yeah. You know, it's so amazing. And you see that central relationship come back so many times, right? It's in Bartlett for America in season 3. It's in some sense kind of a similar thing of like, as long as you're doing the right thing, I'm always going to do the right thing for you too. And I would never sell you out. Right. Like I think you're right. And I never drew that line, Sarah, to Kadams. But it's totally the same thing, which is like, we love these people because they love each other and they'll always be there for each other.
I also think, Sarah, you mentioned something, the father figure element, which is something that they don't really, that Bartlett doesn't wrap his arms around until kind of the later half of this season. But it really becomes a real kind of tenet of his character. When I think about, I would argue it might very well be in The Shadow of Two Gunmen, the way that he is with Josh, you can see that that they're his family and that he will lay down in traffic for these people. And that just, it gives the show so much heart. It just makes you love him so much.
Yeah, that is 100%. When I pitched the bold type, I pitched the Melora Hart and the Jacqueline character as the Bartlett. I said, she will, the show belongs to her staff. Like, that's where the soapy stories will be, but she is the moral center and she is the one who they all look to and who like flies in to give guidance and love and unconditional support. And that was the show. And I thought, you know, the West Wing, how they used the biggest actor in the whole group in the smallest way, but in such an impactful way, is something that I sought to model in the bold type.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more in terms of just making sure that you're, you know, that the rock at the center of your show is the beating heart of the show, that it's the thing that just, and it's something that they learn. I mean, we all know the stories of this show is supposed to be about Sam Seaborn. Ultimately, obviously, it's not. They realize that, you know, that audiences love Martin Sheen. And the show, that pivot, which is so unbelievably important, I can't even imagine what the show is without him. I tweeted about this when I first started doing the miniseries, but it is a towering performance by Martin Sheen that he makes look so easy. Yeah. That he never won an Emmy for the show is just insane. I think about what he brings to this character, his Catholicism, which is something that's very important to Martin Sheen. There's all sorts of things that are imbued in Bartlett that make him feel like this larger than life character, and yet somehow very approachable and very, as you said, very small and grounded. It's an amazing thing. You see it obviously in this particular scene with Leo, and that's the beginning of it, but it really starts to blossom when you see the way that he loves Sam and Toby and see, like, all of them, that it's that he really is the father to them. It's really something special. So around this point, you have Josh and Danny have a conversation about Lillian Field and trying to figure out what his end game is. And Josh tells Danny that CJ likes goldfish. And thus Danny brings her a physical goldfish in a bowl, in a fishbowl. And it's, she says she likes the crackers, not the actual fish themselves. But this might be the first time that we really get to hear Allison Janney's unbelievably wonderful laugh that is infectious and so human. And it's the first time that you start to really get the sense, like, she kisses him on the cheek and, like, he's kind of broken through a little bit. But I mean, Jesus, he still should have known better, but it is what it is. So I want to kind of talk for a second about, I guess, the personification of Republicans in this universe, because I do feel like, I wish we had these Republicans, but
well, kind of did back then. Like, things were not as partisan.
Right.
It was never like this. Like I said, I was super involved in politics at the time before we all got disillusioned and everything. And it was a lot more reasonable. I will say that.
But I would also say too that that one of the things that this show got dinged for was the way that it perceived Republicans, right? Like, it was that this kind of pie in the sky, idealistic perspective of Democratic politics, and that the Republicans weren't painted or, quite frankly, really had any characters. Thus, you have Ainsley Hayes that comes in season two, who I love. And I think Ainsley Hayes is one of the best characters they've done. And
speaking
I wish that
of sexual
I'm...
harassment. There's like a whole episode where it's like you're a sex kitten or something.
Yeah. No, it's not great. I'm not writing for that stuff, just to be clear. But I do think that at the very least, Sorkin tried to find a way into Republican ideology that he could wrap his head around and fold into his universe in a way. It's like, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on Ron Silver's character who comes in, who's also sort of a pseudo Republican?
Bruno,
right. Yeah. Bruno Gianelli, who comes in season three. But he finds ways to bring in smart Republicans that believe in things that he can at least get behind. We've watched political dramas, become Scandal and then House of Cards. And we've seen how political discourse is now shown in television. And I guess my question to you guys is just, do you feel like the Republicans on this show feel like caricatures, or do you feel as though they're at least, fleshed out?
It's interesting. For me, I think my answer sort of is both, which is that I think the necessities of TV drama sort of, particularly this one, though, we stay in the West Wing, right? Occasionally they do those exterior shots, but we are in the West Wing. We are in the point of view of the Bartlett administration. And so when we're looking at the Republicans, we're often looking at them either on a television screen and then it's being commented on by our heroes, or they're talking about something a Republican did. We're not even actually seeing it.
Right?
That it's always within the point of view and the context of the inside the West Wing. And so I think there's a case to be made that what's being perceived as, like, Republicans presented as an enemy is in fact the perception of the characters within the West Wing and what they have to deal with and why it gets minimized. And then you see something like, I don't remember the character's name, but there's an episode. Is it in this episode? It may be in a different episode they're trying to, it's a different episode where they're trying to change, it's Lies, Damn Lives, and Statistics, I think, but they're trying to change the makeup of the FEC, right? Right. And there's a Republican who's for, you know, basically removing money from elections. And that guy very much is willing to make a deal because they agree on that thing, right? Yeah. And that's an interaction that's in person. It's not an interaction through media or through somebody in the administration's personal lens. And so I think there is a case to be made that, like, what you're seeing is a character's perception of the Republican Party, and it's just mostly presented that way throughout the series, but that you might be able to make that case. But that said, they are presented very shy.
Well, they're presented as villains. Yeah. I understand the idea. I mean, listen, they are villains now, it seems. But I do think that back then it was more, it was less full-throated obstructionist nonsense. And there was at least some wiggle room of getting something through, until sort of Newt Gingrich, and it all kind of goes to hell in a handbasket from there for all intents and purposes. I want to highlight a line of Mandy's that made me laugh. She said, getting Mendoza confirmed will be tough. And if all hell breaks loose with Lilienfeld, it could cripple us for a year. What? Like, I mean, it's laughable now to think that any of this would cripple an administration. I'm not sure it would have even done it then. And I understand you need stakes, but, like, it was just laughable.
I didn't even register that line because, honestly, what I love about The West Wing is it has this way of making things that, like, don't feel stakey, feel so stakey.
Right.
Because I'm with you. It's like... I don't know. I remember, like, living through Clarence Thomas, and it's like that was a big deal, and that was a scandal. And even that, like, then he got put on the court, and no big deal.
How? I have a question for you guys. I'm Canadian, so I don't know the answer to this. But how many Supreme Court nominees have not gotten through? I mean, I know Bork is a big one because that was sort of, you know, that was Reagan, and he kind of tripped over himself on that whole nomination. And I believe that Bush W had some dummy that he put up, and they were just like, no. But I'm trying to think of, there can't be that many of them, right?
Not that many, I don't think. But again, like, in the olden days, again, because I'm significantly older than Adam, like, you just didn't pay that much. There was CNN, but we didn't have cable. And so there wasn't that round-the-clock news. And so, like, a Supreme Court justice nominee might get, like, a couple minutes, like, third story deep on the evening news, but it just wasn't like today. And so I think unless somebody was nominated, like Clarence Thomas, where there was this explosive sexual harassment story around it, you didn't pay attention. The stakes didn't feel as high. It felt like whoever got on the court was going to be fair, and judges are nonpartisan. Rah, rah, America.
What a disaster we're in right now. Yeah, I mean, it's looking at the Supreme Court right now, it is disheartening, to say the least. I'm very curious to see what this committee that's been put together is going to suggest to Biden. And I don't know if he can make any real substantive change. We will see.
I do think the thing you said about, like, Mandy's line and that they'll, you know, we're going to be crippled for a year. Mm-hmm. Like it's interesting, right? Because we're all saying that's not going to happen in real life, but he did dramatize exactly that, which is right. When this Lilienfeld story comes to a head in season three, and it's because he won't not back Leo. If he were to not back Leo, he could make it all go away. But because he won't not back Leo, the sort of dramatic climax of the Sorkin years is exactly this thing, this Lilienfeld pills Leo thing coming back to Rose and coming back to Roost, and like them having to, you know, figure out a way to not make it cripple them. Now, whether that is real or not, I think is a different thing than what he chose to dramatize, which is like, he did bring it home.
It's interesting too, because the reason the stakes worked for me is not because of Mandy's line and not because of any like external thing of it's going to cripple the administration. It was because of the personal stakes. So when these characters, because I love these characters, when the characters care deeply about something, I care deeply. So that opening teaser of them on the phone and them being so excited, I'm like, yes, I'm in. I want them to get what they want.
Yep, yep.
And that's what Sorkin does so well, is like the stakes. He takes these very big stakes and makes them extremely personal.
I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this question. I'm trying to figure out the best way to ask it. But with Aaron Sorkin's past with drugs, I feel like, you know, it does seem to be a little bit of a recurring theme, if you will, where he does kind of try to talk about them and try to kind of break down the taboos that we might have about drug use to some degree or another, recreational or otherwise. It's a big part of the Studio 60 pilot, although Studio 60 is just a thinly veiled version of Aaron Sorkin's life, but well, that's neither here nor there. I do think it's interesting that through this Leo stuff, he really does try to get to the heart of addiction and to get to the heart of what I can only assume is things that he was grappling with himself and trying to sort of figure out a way to unpack this, why it's important to us as a society, why we hold addicts as, you know, you know what I'm saying in terms of the fact that like society looks down on them. Like there's just all of this stuff. It's mental health. It's all these things. And I think that he does it in a really interesting way with Leo's character. I know that John Spencer also, if I'm not mistaken, has an alcoholic or had an alcoholic past in his life as well. So there was that too. But I think all of this is just very nuanced, very heartfelt. All of this stuff feels very real. And I can't help but wonder if part of that has to do with Aaron Sorkin's story himself.
I mean, I think it does. By the way, I think it's funny. There's a line in here from when Josh is talking to Leo and he says, you know, you're Boston Irish Catholic. Back then, the problem with drinking wasn't really a problem at all, which is also funny because Leo is
from Chicago.
in another episode.
Oh, yes.
There's a whole monologue about men of Chicago. But like, he did choose to bring that story back, not just in Leo here, but he brings it back at the end with Mendoza, right? Yeah. The answer to the privacy question comes in the form of this storyline about the drug thing. And what would you do if somebody in the workplace was, you know, forced to take a drug test? And he says, I would reinstate that person. It's hard not to wonder if something was going on behind the scenes. In Sports Night, Sorkin writes the network into, right? Like writes the network notes into the show that he's clearly getting on the show. right. That like, it's hard not to wonder if there was something literally going on here and he just decided to write it right into the show.
Well, I also think it's just the thing of like, I deserve love too.
Totally. I
think about how Bartlett is Biden, and like, remember when like this Hunter Biden text messages got hacked, and then what it revealed was that like Biden was an incredibly forgiving, loving father who's like, yeah, I love you no matter what, and your addiction.
That was the scandal.
And again, there's just something so paternal and beautiful about that. And like, if you're struggling with something, and I don't know what Sorkin, like maybe he didn't see it as, no idea. But there is something very beautiful about that message of like, you are not the worst thing that you've done. You are not, this does not define you. That's very beautiful.
I absolutely agree. And you know, I do remember the this whole scandal about Hunter's text and it all revealing that Biden's just a good dad is just like the most perfect encapsulation of the 2020 election that ever was. But I also I want to kind of hone in on the last scene of this episode, which is them talking to Roberto Mendoza, which is Sorkin loves a good name. Like he just gets how to write names really well. Roberto Mendoza is just a great name. He doesn't really get grilled as hard as Harrison does though in the Oval Office. Harrison's like really put to task and Mendoza's asked one question. So he's like, I'm good. I'm fine. That's basically it. But there's something about Edward James Olmos's presence. Like just the way he holds himself in that room, his voice, just everything about him is just, and obviously they go even deeper into that with Celestial Navigation, but it just goes to show that casting is just so important. The guy's got four lines. And when he's walking through the West Wing and they're applauding him, you're like, yeah, fuck yeah, this guy deserves it. He said four lines. There's nothing to base it on other than that Edward James Olmos is awesome.
But I think it's his response, right? When sure. when Harrison is in that chair yes. and is being questioned, and he says, I'm a very well-credentialed man. And like that should mean I shouldn't be questioned, right? The implication, the subtext of his emotions and his response is I come from great schools and I worked at great law firms and I've clerked for the right people. And so how dare you question
me? Yeah, Kavanaugh.
And I was literally just going to say it's so Kavanaugh. It made me think so much of him. Yeah.
But it's I think what Sorkin is putting up is he's made an episode about, you know, race where he doesn't actually speak about it.
Yeah.
Right. And like Mendoza gets up there and they ask him questions and he answers, you know, forthright and he doesn't sweat at all. He's just like, and he thinks he's up for a much smaller job. Yes, he thinks he's up for a position on the president's council on like,
Hispanic something or other.
Something or other, right? Like I don't even know if they finished the sentence in it because they made it up. It doesn't actually, they're like, Mandy's like, I had to make fake letterhead. Yeah. So like, I think it's really, to me, the thing there is that it's really that it's the response to the being questioned that makes Bartlett go, this is our guy, right? Yeah. You know?
I think there's something about an underdog. It's something about, you take the entitled Kavanaugh guy who's expected his whole life to be given this thing. And then you take this incredibly sincere man who has spent his whole life fighting for justice, but has not had every opportunity handed to him. And then you surprise him with it. And there's just something we want the sincere underdogs to win. And so there's something about like all the staffers like lining up to cheer him on that.
No, for sure.
I think they more overtly brought this episode around to race either in the script or even there's the scene between Charlie and Harrison.
Yes,
and he says, the country club, right? Yeah. That scene exists. Oh, the exact scene almost exists at the end of the first season when one of Bartlett's ambassadors gets fired from for having an affair with the daughter of the prime minister of Brazil. And Charlie's sitting in the room with the guy and says, I used to work at the Gramercy Club. That's how you know me. And like the guy realizes, he's like, oh, I quit that place because of their policies for rich. I think they did the exact same thing here where like you turned out that it was like a very white country club that Charlie was, you know, three seasons caddying at. And I think they decided to kind of like
know what I thought was going to happen? Like, and I even remembered in my mind, and then I'm like, how did I remember the scene in my head that doesn't exist?
Because it comes later.
It's later in the season.
I thought that Harrison was it Harrison?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought he was going to come to Bartlett and be like, you took my nomination away because like I was racist at the country club. Right. And Bartlett's like, wait, Charlie's like too decent a man to ever tell.
Right.
And like in my head, that scene was coming. And then when it never came, it was so...
That was how strong the subtext was. Yeah, it's you feel an energy in that scene, an unspoken energy between Harrison and Charlie that obviously we've watched the show many times and projected a later similar scene into it, but still there's something there that you can't really put your finger on, which I think is just ultimately kind of just left to kind of go away, but it still underlines you're not supposed to like this guy. Like you just don't like Harrison. He's just an uppity white guy who's just like had everything, you know, he's whatever. I do think it's interesting that, you know, that they never really say that Mendoza is, I mean, they say he's Hispanic, but they just don't really underline the idea. I think what's also interesting too is, you know, the episode opens obviously with that scene with the justice where he really says, like, give him a shot, take a risk, grow a spine, what have you. And I think by the end of this episode, you really get the feeling that Bartlett, who has always been the guy who wants to do the right thing. I mean, we see it in the flashback stuff in The Shadow of Two Gunmen, where he's willing to tax farmers more because he wants it to be easier for people to get milk. And that he doesn't, you know, I mean, these are the things, these are kind of the DNA of this character. And I think you're seeing now this turn or a shift in his character of being like, I want to fight for these things. I don't want to take the easy road, and Mendoza's going to be harder, but it's the right choice. Like this idea of what's right and what's tough being synonymous is something that the show really starts to run with past this point.
I mean, is Let Bartlett by B. Bartlett after this episode? It is.
Correct, right? Yes.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's coming up in a few episodes and that really brings this all to a serious head where he has to be the guy he wants to be.
Yeah. I think that it's all sort of, and you kind of mentioned this too, Sarah, but I mean, when he picks Mendoza, like I can't help but cry at this stuff. Like the show just understands. I mean, listen, it just hits me in that place. Yeah. That score comes in, and you're just like, this is the best. Everyone's so good. Think about what we could do if we just were better. It's really special. And I mean, Edward James Olmos just brings this weight to it as well that you just love him. But I want to ask you guys what your favorite episodes are of The West Wing. Adam, do you want to go first?
Yeah, make Adam go first. Because I want to say to all the listeners that Phil even emailed us and said he was going to ask this question so that we wouldn't be put on the spot. And then I totally forgot to think about it.
It's fine.
I have a weird
answer. You have a couple. It's fine if you do.
Yeah, I have a weird answer because I obviously love... I think if you were to ask me what the best episode of the show is, you know, I would be like, it's either like... Two Cathedrals or 17 People or like Posse Comitatus, like one of those three. But what's interesting to me is there's an episode I come back to over and over again in a weird way, which is We Killed Yamamoto, which is the episode before Posse Comitatus. And it's a transitionary episode, but there's something great about the Bartlett relationship with the military that throughout the series, but you really are getting at his like, conflict there because he's had a lot of experiences so far, and it's him wanting to take care of somebody, not willing to use sort of violence to solve a problem, and needing and being and essentially giving up on it once he realizes that the Justice Department isn't going to be able to handle the problem. He almost is willing to let this terrorist go, and it's one of the few times I think where. And like the military, it's the scene between John Amos and John Spencer where he says, you have to tell him he can't let this guy just go home. He can't cancel this meeting. He has to have the meeting that's going to lead to him assassinating a politician from another country. Like that scene between the two of them where he says, you know, we killed Yamamoto, you know, you got to tell him he can't do this is there's something about that episode that even though it's a transition between like it's leading to the big episode, which is the next one where he's actually going to do it. I come back to that episode all the time. And I think it's because there's a lot of these talking heads in rooms that are one-on-ones in that episode that are really good. Sorkin does really well.
Yeah, I was thinking about the fact that like television for all intents and purposes is people talking in rooms, right? Like that's what it is. And that's what Sorkin loves. He loves people sitting in rooms on two sides of an argument, both being incredibly smart and researched and making the audience for all intents and purposes come to their own conclusions about what they should or shouldn't do. And that is a perfect crystallization of it, right? Like seeing these two great actors in this room debating the ultimately maybe one of the biggest things that's going to happen in this administration. And it really just comes down to two people in a room, which is, you know, a beautiful, amazing thing. But I love that episode too. I mean, I love them all, but Sarah, do you have
One of them is everybody's favorite episode. Adam, what's the name of the Christmas one where Toby finds
Noel?
No.
That's In Excelsis Deo.
Yeah, when they
the next find, episode.
Yes, when the homeless man is found with Toby's business card in his coat that Toby had given to Goodwill. I mean, I can't. I would describe the episode, but I'll start openly weeping. So instead, the other one is it's when Bartlett is, I believe, up for re-election, and they Donna, Josh, and Toby go to the state fair. Yeah. And there's two things I really like about it. And what state are they even in? They're somewhere in the
Iowa.
Iowa, I think. And Toby and Josh are such snobs about it the whole time. And they're one, I liked that they were out of the White House, and there was just something about seeing that. And Sorkin even talks about that episode in his masterclass, because he talks about like how he found out that if you miss the bus, you just get left behind. Like, so this whole episode was built from that. But what I loved about it is my family is from Wisconsin, and I spent summers going to the 4-H fair and, you know, taking pride in my grandpa's cows when they won blue ribbons. Aww. And Toby and Josh were just, there was this elitism the whole time, that for the first part of the episode, you're supposed to be like, oh, they're so cool because they work in the White House. And then at the end of the episode, Donna just lays into them and is like, you know, you laughed at them the whole time, but never, like, I'm going to start crying, like saw the pride they take in their heirloom tomatoes, or like just this, like the sincerity of these people, which are my people. And there was just something so unexpected about that. And I loved seeing Donna like have a voice also, because 1999 was a time when women were not, you know, obviously CJ was in this powerful role, but for the most part, it was men in these roles. And Donna is somebody who you could tell who, like, if she had grown up 20 years later, she would have been Josh or Toby. She was that smart, but she just probably never was pushed in the same ways or had the opportunities. And like, maybe I'm overthinking this whole episode, but thought there was something so magical about that moment. And now
Donna gets me all the time. The scene that gets me in season 3 is her in the Oval Office talking to her high school teacher.
Yeah.
And oh, saying, I'm in the White House and it's because of you. And you're just like, it's like, I mean, every time I think about it, it makes me emotional. Like, it's such a really, I think part of it is also Janelle Maloney, who is, has, who I've actually met in person. I got a hug from Janelle Maloney once. She has no idea who I am. It doesn't matter. But she was so lovely.
I got mistaken for her at a yoga class once.
It's the same thing. It's basically the same thing. But I do feel like she's just a very genuine person. And she just feels like a real person. It's not to say that these other characters don't, but on some level, they're on like rarefied air. She feels like a real person. So when you have these moments like them trapped in Iowa in 20 hours in America, or, you know, her in the Oval Office in Stirred, she's just such a beautiful soul. Like, you just really feel that about her. The other thing about 20 Hours in America that I love, and it comes to what you were talking about as well, Sarah, is the bet that Josh and Toby have.
I'm Toby's killer, and I work in the White House.
And the end, when he says it, and it makes you cry, and you're just like, God damn it, you took this stupid runner of a joke, and you made it into something that crippled me. Like, it's just, like, that's the beauty of the show. I mean, it really is just that they can take that stuff.
I can cry just describing it.
No, I did. I mean, I got misty-eyed thinking about Donna and the fucking Oval Office and their teacher.
And Donna's from Wisconsin, by the way. Just so
there you go. That's why you love her so much.
From like Minnesota. Was it Wisconsin?
No, it's Wisconsin. Yeah. She's very close to the Canadian border because she lives.
But might have been a Canadian.
she was Canadian for a hot minute there. It's amazing. It's an amazing show. And watching that masterclass also just really sort of you know, I watched this show for so many years, and it seems, it still seems unattainable to me in terms of the level of talent and just all the things that they did on this show. But then you see Sorkin talking, and you're just like, he's just a guy in front of a computer like us.
I know.
And it really just makes you feel
better.
Were
you expecting him to talk like one of his characters? And then he doesn't.
And, you're and like, he stammers and he goes off topic and he just says all the time and hates a blank screen with a cursor as much as we do. It really does make the whole thing feel just so much more human.
Yeah.
It really does.
So this has been an ad for Masterclass.
Yeah, this is it. Maybe we can get them as a sponsor. That'd be great because they're real expensive, guys, FYI.
And I highly recommend the Masterclass with the hostage negotiator who teaches you how to negotiate. Really good.
That sounds intense. Really good. And I'll look into that one. Thank you both so much for coming on to talk about this with me. I really do appreciate it. And I hope that you'll both come back to talk about some other television show down the road.
Loved it. 1999 was a special year for me.
A special year. Thank you so much, guys. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. 1999, podcast like it. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.